Welcome back to the Next Chapter News. Tonight, we're going to be diving into a case that has haunted the Blue Ridge Mountains for over three decades.
The unsolved murder of Cynthia Kirk.
Yeah.
Just picture this. Boone, North Carolina, April 8th, 1989.
Okay.
It's a seemingly peaceful college town, you know, but that tranquility was shattered.
Yeah.
When 35-year-old Cindy was found strangled in her own home.
Oh, wow.
And despite an extensive investigation, her killer has never been found.
So we are here tonight to examine the facts, explore the lingering questions, and see if we can uncover any new insights into this perplexing cold case.
You ready to play detective with us?
I am ready. Let's get into it.
Well, let's start with what we know. The stark reality is that information about Cindy's life is surprisingly scarce.
Oh, really?
It's almost as if she's become a ghost in her own story.
Wow.
This lack of detail isn't just sad. It potentially hindered the initial investigation.
I see.
Without a robust understanding of who Cindy was, her relationships, her routines, investigators were likely working with a limited view of her world.
That's a really good point. It makes you wonder why there's so little information available. Was this an oversight in the early stages of the investigation? Or was Cindy someone who kept to herself, making it harder to piece together her life after the fact?
That's a question worth considering. It's possible that the focus in 1989 was more on the immediate forensic evidence and less on building a complete picture of Cindy as a person. And remember, this was before social media.
Right.
Today, investigators would have a digital trail to follow, but back then it was largely up to personal interviews and physical records.
So let's go back to that fateful day in April 1989. Walk us through what we know about the discovery of Cindy's body and the initial steps taken by law enforcement.
On April 8th, Cindy was found in her home.
Okay.
The cause of death, strangulation.
Okay.
Now, that detail is significant. Strangulation suggests a very personal, up-close attack, often fueled by rage or a desire for control. Mm. It wasn't a random act of violence from afar.
Right.
The killer was in that room with Cindy.
That's a chilling thought, and it immediately makes you wonder about the relationship between Cindy and her attacker.
Right.
Was this someone she knew? Someone she led into her home?
The reports don't indicate signs of forced entry, which could point to a level of familiarity, but we can't rule anything out at this stage. Investigators would have combed the scene for any trace of the killer, fingerprints, DNA fibers, anything that could provide a lead.
And what about interviews? Did anyone in Cindy's circle report seeing anything suspicious or notice any changes in her behavior in the days leading up to her death?
The Uncovered Profile, our primary source for this case, states that despite extensive interviews with neighbors, friends, and family, no clear suspect emerged. This lack of leads is incredibly frustrating, but it also speaks to the limitations of relying solely on eyewitness accounts.
Okay.
Memories can be unreliable, details get muddled, and sometimes people simply don't notice things until it's too late.
It's like trying to piece together a shattered mirror. You have all these fragments, but it's difficult to see the full picture. And this was 1989. We've talked about DNA analysis being in its early stages. What specific limitations might investigators have faced back then?
Imagine trying to identify someone from a blurry photograph.
Okay.
That's essentially what DNA analysis was like back then. It could exclude suspects, but getting a definitive match was much more challenging. Plus, the process was slow. It could take weeks or even months to get results.
Right.
Today, we have databases, rapid testing, and the ability to analyze even minute traces of DNA. Back then, investigators needed a substantial sample, and even then, the results were often inconclusive.
So it's possible that crucial evidence was collected at the scene, but the technology at the time wasn't sophisticated enough to make use of it. That's a tough pill to swallow, knowing that the answers might have been there all along, just out of reach.
And that's where the potential for modern forensic techniques to revisit this case becomes so intriguing. We'll delve into that a bit later, but first, there's another curious detail we need to unpack. A detail that adds a layer of complexity to this already perplexing case.
Okay, I'm all ears. What's this new wrinkle in the story?
While researching this case, we came across a potential discrepancy in records.
Okay.
The Durham, North Carolina government website lists Cindy Kirk, found dead in her home in August of 1989.
Oh, wow.
However, this record indicates that she died from stab wounds, not strangulation. Mm. And the location is Durham, not Boone.
Well, wait a minute. Are we talking about two separate cases involving women named Cynthia Kirk who died just a few months apart? Or could this be a clerical error?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Right.
It's not uncommon for inconsistencies to pop up in older cases, especially when you're dealing with paper records and potentially outdated systems, but it's a detail we can't ignore.
Absolutely. It's like finding an extra piece of a puzzle that doesn't quite fit.
Yeah.
It makes you question everything you thought you knew. So for the sake of clarity, we're focusing on the Boone case, correct?
That's right. The Boone case is the one consistently cited in relation to Cindy Kirk's murder. But this discrepancy in records definitely raises questions about the accuracy and completeness of the information available. It's a good reminder to approach all sources with a critical eye and consider multiple perspectives.
All right, so with this potential discrepancy in mind, let's dive into some of the possible theories surrounding Cindy's death. What are some of the leading possibilities that have been considered over the years?
One theory is that Cindy's murder was a crime of opportunity. Boone, you know, with its influx of students and visitors, could have made Cindy's home a target for someone just passing through.
That's a chilling thought. A stranger seeing an opportunity and taking advantage of the situation. But wouldn't that be even more difficult to solve? I mean, if there's no prior connection between Cindy and the killer, how do you even begin to narrow down the suspects?
Exactly. That's the challenge with crimes of opportunity.
Right.
The pool of potential suspects is vast and seemingly random. Investigators would be looking for any shred of evidence that could link someone to the scene. A fingerprint, a stray hair, a witness placing someone in the area around the time of the murder.
It's like searching for a needle in a haystack.
But what about the possibility that the killer was someone Cindy knew? Someone who had a motive, maybe a personal grudge, or perhaps someone trying to cover up another crime?
That's the other side of the coin. If it was someone Cindy knew, there's a chance they were invited into the home, explaining the lack of forced entry.
Okay.
And a personal relationship, while tragic, could provide a starting point for the investigation. Did Cindy have any conflicts with anyone? Were there any strained relationships in her life? Those are questions investigators would have explored.
It's unsettling to think that someone close to Cindy could be capable of such a horrific act. But statistically speaking, most victims know their attacker. Do we have any insights into Cindy's social circle? Was she outgoing? Did she have a large network of friends and acquaintances? That's where the lack of information becomes a major roadblock.
Right.
Without a clear picture of Cindy's life, it's hard to say who might have had a motive or opportunity.
It's like trying to solve a puzzle where half the pieces are missing. You can see the general shape, but the details remain obscured. Do we know anything about the neighborhood where Cindy lived? Was it considered safe? Were there any other crimes reported in the area around that time?
From what we can gather, Cindy lived in a relatively quiet residential area not far from the university campus. Boone, in 1989, was for the most part considered a safe town. Of course, every community has its share of crime, but there's nothing to suggest that Cindy's neighborhood was particularly dangerous.
So it wasn't like she was living in a high crime area where random acts of violence were commonplace. This adds another layer to the mystery. Was it truly a random act? Or was Cindy specifically targeted for some unknown reason?
Those are the questions that have lingered for over 30 years, and it's why cold cases like this continue to fascinate and frustrate us. We crave answers, we want justice for the victim, but the path to those answers can be incredibly elusive.
Speaking of answers, let's revisit the potential impact of modern forensic techniques. If evidence was collected at Cindy's home back in 1989, could it be re-examined using today's technology? Could we finally unlock some of those missing pieces of the puzzle?
Absolutely. The advancements in forensic science over the past 3 decades are nothing short of remarkable. DNA analysis has come a long way. What might have been a blurry photograph back then could be a high-definition image today. Even trace amounts of DNA, something as small as a skin cell, can now be analyzed and potentially lead to a positive identification.
So it's not just about re-examining existing evidence. It's about the possibility of finding new clues within that evidence thanks to these technological advancements. That's incredibly hopeful.
Exactly. Imagine a fingerprint that was too smudged to analyze in 1989. Today, with advanced imaging techniques, we might be able to lift a clear print from that same evidence. And with databases containing millions of DNA profiles, a match that was impossible to find back then could be just a few keystrokes away now.
It's like having a whole new set of eyes looking at the case eyes that can see things that were previously invisible. But what of the evidence itself? After all these years, is there a chance it's been degraded or lost?
That's a valid concern. Evidence preservation is crucial in any investigation, and the longer a case goes unsolved, the greater the risk of evidence being lost, damaged, or simply forgotten.
It's almost as if time itself becomes an accomplice to the crime obscuring the truth and making it that much harder to find justice.
That's a powerful way to put it. But even with the passage of time, there's always hope. Evidence can be surprisingly resilient. And with proper storage and handling, even decades-old samples can yield valuable insights.
So what needs to happen to get Cindy's case reopened and her evidence re-examined? Who makes that call?
Typically, it's up to the law enforcement agency that originally handled the case.
Okay.
They would need to be convinced that there's a reasonable chance of finding new leads using modern forensic techniques. That often requires a dedicated cold case unit resources that are sadly lacking in many jurisdictions.
So it's not just about the technology. It's about having the manpower and the will to revisit these cold cases. It's about recognizing that justice delayed doesn't have to mean justice denied.
Absolutely. And it's about remembering the victims, remembering Cindy Kirk and the countless other individuals whose stories have been silenced by the passage of time.
You mentioned other cases. Are there any in North Carolina that share similarities with Cindy's case, perhaps unsolved murders of women in seemingly safe environments?
Sadly, there are far too many. The case of Brittany Locklear comes to mind. In 1998, this young girl was abducted and murdered in Hope County, and despite extensive efforts, her case remains unsolved. Emma Mae Terry, murdered in 1990, and Kathy Kennedy, who disappeared in 1994, are just two more examples of lives cut short, families left without answers, and communities grappling with the enduring pain of unsolved crimes.
It's heartbreaking to think about all the families who have endured years, even decades, without knowing what happened to their loved ones. Does the fact that Cindy was a woman make her case more challenging? Are there any biases or patterns in how these types of cases are handled?
That's a complex question and one that deserves a deeper conversation.
Yeah.
But for now, I think it's important to acknowledge that every victim deserves justice, regardless of gender, race, or any other factor. And every case, no matter how old or cold, has the potential to be solved.
That's a message worth repeating. Every case matters. Every victim deserves justice. Now let's shift gears a bit and try to put ourselves back in 1989. Paint a picture for us. What was the atmosphere like in Boone back then? How did this crime impact the town's sense of safety and its collective psyche? Boone in the late 80s. I imagine it as a place where people felt safe, where neighbors knew each other, where the biggest worry might have been your team losing the homecoming game.
Right.
Then suddenly there's a brutal murder in a quiet neighborhood. That has to shatter the illusion of safety.
Absolutely. And the fact that Cindy's murder remains unsolved only compounds that unease. Imagine living in that community knowing that someone capable of such violence is still out there, potentially living among them. It creates a lingering sense of vulnerability, a shadow that hangs over the town.
You can't help but wonder how the unsolved nature of this case ripples through the community even today. Do people still talk about it? Has it changed the way they interact with their surroundings?
It's hard to say for certain without speaking to the people who lived through it, but I imagine it's had a lasting impact. Perhaps people are more cautious, more aware of their surroundings. Maybe they double-check their locks at night or think twice about walking alone after dark. These are subtle but significant changes in behavior that can stem from a collective trauma like an unsolved murder.
It's a reminder that the impact of these crimes extends far beyond the immediate victim and their family. It touches the entire community, leaving a scar that can take generations to heal.
And that's why it's so important to keep these stories alive. Not to exploit the tragedy, but to honor the victims, to seek justice, and to remind ourselves that these cases are not just cold files. They represent real people whose lives were cut short, whose stories deserve to be told.
Speaking of telling stories, you mentioned earlier that you'd like to revisit the potential for modern forensic techniques to help solve Cindy's case. Can you elaborate on that? What specifically could be done today that wasn't possible in 1989?
Let's start with DNA. We've touched on the advancements in DNA analysis, but it's worth reiterating just how powerful a tool it has become. Imagine investigators were able to recover even a tiny amount of DNA from the crime scene, a skin cell under Cindy's fingernail, a stray hair on her clothing. That sample could be run through national DNA databases, potentially matching it to a known offender, or even identifying a distant relative, providing a new lead for investigators.
That's incredible. It's like having a time machine for evidence. But DNA isn't the only area where technology has advanced. What about other forensic techniques?
Fingerprint technology has also made significant strides. What might have been a smudged or partial print back then could be analyzed and enhanced today, potentially leading to a positive identification. And there are other tools at our disposal, facial recognition software, digital forensics, even techniques for analyzing microscopic trace evidence that were unheard of in 1989.
So it's not just about re-examining the existing evidence. It's about looking at it with fresh eyes, using cutting-edge technology to uncover clues that were previously hidden. It's almost like giving the investigation a second chance.
Exactly. And sometimes that second chance is all it takes to break a case wide open. We've seen it happen time and time again with cold cases that were seemingly unsolvable until new technology or a fresh perspective came along.
It's a powerful reminder that we should never give up hope. There's always the possibility of finding answers, even in cases that have gone cold for decades.
And that hope is what keeps investigators, families, and advocates pushing for justice. It's what drives organizations like Uncovered to keep these stories in the spotlight, to raise awareness, and to encourage anyone with even the smallest piece of information to come forward.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into the unsolved murder of Cynthia Kirk, what's the one message you want our listeners to take away from this case?
Never forget Cindy. Never forget her story. And never lose hope that one day her killer will be brought to justice.
Well said. And to our listeners, if you have any information about the murder of Cynthia Kirk, no matter how insignificant it may seem, please reach out to the Boone Police Department or the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation. Even the smallest detail could be the missing piece of the puzzle that finally brings closure to this tragic case.
And remember, every tip, every voice that speaks up for the victims of unsolved crimes brings us one step closer to a world where justice prevails no matter how much time has passed.
Thank you for joining us tonight on the Next Chapter News. We'll continue to explore these unsolved mysteries to shed light on the darkness and to advocate for justice for all. Until next time, stay curious, stay informed, and never stop seeking the truth.